Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd. I'm founder and CEO of the City's First podcast, as well as City's First Advisors. And I'm super excited to have with me here today two leaders in shared and active mobility on both sides of the pond, as we say, both sides of the Atlantic. We have Sandra Witzel, who is Chief Marketing Officer and member of many boards in the UK and across the globe, representing SCEDGO, one of the leading mobility as a service platforms. Welcome, Sandra, for joining us.
Hi there.
And then we also have Alexandra Carroll, who represents the city of Alexandria, Virginia, in the US. And I believe, Alex, your title is Complete Streets Manager, but I believe I'm missing a bit more of your title and background, maybe if you want to remind the audience.
Yeah, sure. Great to be with you, first of all. I'm the Complete Streets Program Manager for the city's Department
Program
of
manager.
Transport.
Yes.
Yes, for the
Okay.
city's Department of Transportation. I also manage our Vision Zero program, but it doesn't make its way into the title.
See, I knew it was a long title. Like, I'm missing some. I bet it's better just to let you let the audience know what it is. So today's theme is kind of our quarterly webinar podcast. Today we're just doing a podcast, but typically it's more of a webinar live stream. But our quarterly format is more of a roundtable, and today's theme is women in shared and active mobility. So we kind of curated different guests from, again, both sides of the pond, with a little bit of more of a European UK and a US perspective on what's happening in this disruptive industry, especially post-COVID, in sustainable modal shift and really active in micromobility. So we want to kind of delve deep into these topics. And with that, I think we'll just get started here with our theme again, which is women in shared and active mobility. So, if everyone is kind of familiar, my audience, with our podcast and format, we start with a series of questions. We'll leave it to both speakers to just give us their final thoughts, and then we'll just kind of wrap things up in just a really brief exchange. So, the first question I have, which I will start, I think we'll start you with Sandra, is please share some recent shared mobility business model and success stories that you've seen in the industry. Let's say whether it relates to mobility as a service, micromobility, or other shared schemes that you're seeing, let's say in the UK and in mainland Europe right now.
Okay, so I want to go a little bit off script here
That's
and
okay.
share an old success story,
That's fine too. Yeah,
and
it could be older news.
that goes all the way over to Australia, where I used to live for 8 years,
Oh.
and it's car shares, shared mobility with cars, and we're just sort of seeing the news that Uber is pulling out of their car share. So they bought Car Next Door a while ago, which was an Australian sort of peer-to-peer car share network. And they're now pulling that. But in Australia, there's an incredible success story of car sharing, and that is called GoGet. And GoGet's been in existence, I think, for over 20 years now. And they started out with three cars in their neighborhood in Melbourne, maybe. And they've now got a really big fleet. I used to use GoGet. I never owned a car when I lived in Australia. I lived in inner city Sydney for a while, and I used GoGet and public transport, and then supplemented with car rental for longer trips. And they're still really going strong. Looking at their numbers, looking at their performance, they're the main supplier in Australia. They're providing an incredible service, and they're just a really solid business that has grown slowly, built over time. I think they only ever did one fundraising round right at the beginning, and that was it. So I would assume they've grown in a way that is profitable and that is not built on investment rounds. And I think they're just a really fantastic story that isn't talked about enough, where someone has created a valid business model and set it up in a way that it's been working for over 2 decades. I think that's a really brilliant story.
So it's a self-sustaining car share operation. You don't hear much about this in Australia, New Zealand, to be honest with you. Australia is kind of notorious to be a car-centric culture, even though you have interesting anomalies, perhaps in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, in the city center, Brisbane. Sorry, I mispronounced that. And really, I think that this is an interesting use case that goes back historically, and it's a lesson learned that's maybe applied more at scale, such that the proliferation of free-floating and station-based car share, which is wildly popular, or at least it's achieved steady state in the German-speaking countries, especially Austria and Germany, is pretty much the heart of car share in continental Europe. So it's a really good, I would say, example from abroad that we can apply to multiple markets. So yeah, I really appreciate you kind
Well,
of
it's
sharing.
interesting because I then moved to the US and then from the US moved to the UK. And in the US, I still used car sharing. So I lived in San Francisco and there was Zipcar, they were very present. And then I supplemented with a lot with pool, Uber pool and Lyft pool and just general sort of ride sharing and also used Turo and also used public transport in San Francisco. I tried using sort of more regional trains in the US, but that was an interesting experiment that didn't work so well. But then moving to the UK, moving to London, where you'd think these car sharing models will be incredibly successful because of the population density, but there just wasn't a density of cars available. So it didn't work. So in London, actually, my husband and I, we ended up buying a car because we couldn't make that system work. It was too far to the car shares. It was too far to public transport, even though we still lived in North London, sort of quite close to the centre. And so it's a real shame that it hasn't really translated successfully in the UK. And even in sort of in new development complexes where there's high density of people, quite often they don't get the spaces for the car shares, which is a real shame because I think that would really help get cars off the road in the UK, which we desperately need because we're such a densely populated island with way too many cars on the road. So I'm really hoping that those examples will help the UK make better progress in these areas.
Yeah, just to kind of close out this thought here, and then we're going to hand it off to Alex, is basically the car share model and the car share market has really vacillated over the last 5 years, pre and post COVID. We've seen a lot of exits in the car share market in North America, especially in the Pacific Northwest, if you look at Seattle, Portland, et cetera. So it's ebbed and flowed. It hasn't been consistent. While you might have had a positive experience in San Francisco or the Bay Area, it has been very spotty. And Alex can probably speak about this too. The examples maybe like Free to Move in Washington, D.C. I used Free to Move as my former employer in another life in mobility as a service. So there's some interesting threads around that. But there's more work to be done. I think the verdict is not out in terms of what those sustainable business models are. But I appreciate you sharing that. Now, on to our next question. Alex is around policy. So, what are your thoughts on what are the policy implications of active and shared mobility? Super broad question. You can answer it however you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, such a good question, and so many different avenues we could take this. And so, like when this question gets introduced, here's what comes to mind for me. It's like, how do we handle placement of vehicles? What are the policies around usage of these vehicles? What are the infrastructure implications of having active and shared mobility programs? And how do we make it equitable, right? So these are all considerations that we're having to go through, not just in Alexandria, but I'm sure in many places, about how to integrate these programs into our systems and make sure that they're easy and safe and accessible and equitable. So, just some of the questions that we've grappled with, and I'll, focusing specifically on, people who are riding their personal bikes or scooters, or who are walking, or people who are participating in a shared mobility enterprise, whether that's our Capital Bike Share program in the DC area, or whether that's any of the like dockless programs like BIRD or Lime. Like, where should these be placed? We have worked very hard. Our curbside management program has worked very hard to implement dockless scooter corrals to sort of improve the predictability and orderliness of these vehicles, because I think we've all heard, sort of the horror stories of scooters being left in the middle of the sidewalk and things like that. And we certainly want to try to mitigate any like negative externalities, because it's such a benefit. It's a tremendous public benefit, but we do need to make sure that they're not obstructing people who are walking, people who have mobility impairments. So, the placement of vehicles has been really important. Policy, helmet rules and where different vehicles are allowed to ride and things like that. I know a lot of communities are grappling with, well, should scooters be allowed to ride on sidewalks? And in Alexandria, they're not permitted to ride on sidewalks. And I think there's certainly, you can certainly argue both sides of that. I think one of the major concerns in our community when our dockless mobility program was introduced just 5-ish years ago was, well, how is that going to impact people who are using the sidewalk? This is a very walkable area generally, and so the sidewalks can be very busy, can be very crowded in some instances, and so introducing like a fast moving vehicle, a relatively fast moving vehicle, can be sort of perceived as a hazard. And so there's that side of it, but then it's also like, well, if you don't allow people to scoot or bike on the sidewalk, then where can they ride? And so then we have to really reassess what infrastructure we're providing to enable people to travel safely, right? So we have a number of infrastructure projects underway right now, where a lot of the concerns we have heard from the communities, like too many people are scooting on the sidewalk, too many people are biking on the sidewalk, and that's a hazard for me when I'm walking my dog. And in the grand scheme of things, it's not the most severe risk. Like, we're really focused on vehicle crashes, which tend to do the most damage, but we do have to listen to those folks as well. And well, how do we address that issue? Well, we can provide people safe places to ride that are separate from the sidewalks. I know for me personally, I wouldn't want to share the road on a scooter with fast moving traffic if there's no dedicated facility for me. And I know a lot of people feel the same way. So how do we lean into human nature and human needs of wanting to feel safe? You can't just throw the book at somebody and say, you can't ride on the sidewalk. You kind of have to enable them to make the decisions that you want them to make. So providing bike lanes, scooter lanes, things like that, just to try to separate the modes where there might be conflicts and give people that dedicated space to ride. And then equity is such a huge issue too. So when we had our dockless mobility program first launch in the city, pretty much all of the vehicles were sited in our most densely populated, tourist-oriented, historic, wealthy neighborhoods that are already reaping many benefits in a lot of different ways. But then in other parts of our community where it's maybe a little less dense, or maybe there's lower income communities, underserved communities, things like that, they were not reaping the same benefits. And so we've had to work with providers to make sure that distribution is more equitable, so that it's not only the one part of our town that's benefiting from this service, that our entire community can benefit as well. And on the active mobility front, and not just the shared aspect, it's something we've been working very hard to do as well, is try to distribute investments more evenly across our city to make sure that people are sharing equitably in the benefits that we can provide through safety improvements and mobility enhancements and things like that. So.
Yeah, it's definitely a push and pull. Thanks, Alex, for sharing. And it's the, highlights the tension between the public and private sector, getting the best from operators, but also kind of delivering on the policy mandates and, let's say, ambitions of cities and municipalities to deliver on access, equity, distribution, as well as improvements in shared and active public infrastructure. Obviously, this is a trend that has accelerated during COVID. Something I've written and spoken about quite prolifically recently is about, kind of how the pandemic has really kind of been this catalyst for investments on the part of the public sector in new shared and active modes, really. And really, it's about, and this is a personal opinion, but you may or may not agree, you and Sandra, but as an urban planner myself, my view is we've reached a tipping point since 2020 in terms of ameliorating or fixing the poor urban planning decisions over the last century, since the early 1920s. So we have basically one century, 100 years of poor urban planning that was single use, autocentric, as well as very binary. And it was rooted in modernism. It was rooted in internationalism. It was rooted in, techno-futuristic schemes of viewing cities as machines, as functionary units. If we look back to, kind of the architects of the time, Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier, and all these others that were schooled in the Bauhaus, and all these different modernist concepts, which translated into like, Robert Moses in New York City and others, where basically we distributed and we segregated functions and activities in the built environment such that we are left with a lot of this, deleterious, really dysfunctional environment that we're trying to stitch together and weave together actual fabrics of our communities in a way such that, active transportation, shared mobility, and other new, let's say, incremental tactical urbanist interventions are seen as a way to reconstruct and take a bottom-up approach to urban planning. So it's basically the flip side of Robert Moses. And it's, essentially supporting a lot of the writing and theories of Jane Jacobs in The Death and Life of American Cities. So we get back to that, really community-based approach. And I think a lot of these concepts we're talking about to support a lot of these theories that urbanists amongst ourselves are very passionate about. And we're seeing, again, accelerate and starting to, bear fruit. So it's, for me personally, I can't speak for you both, but I think it's a very exciting time right now.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it's an exciting and it's also a frustrating time because we have so much momentum and so much energy around this movement to try to make our communities more walkable, more bikeable, more transit friendly. But a lot of times we're slowed down by the natural like bureaucracies that come
Vested
along with
interests, yes.
implementing that change, you
And the
know?
status quo.
Absolutely. And we want
Lobbies, of course.
things, yeah, and we
Oh, yeah.
want things to happen fast. Like we
Yeah.
want to see that change. There's so much energy around it. And I talk with community members about this all the time who are like, oh, I really want to see this roadway redesigned to have like better crosswalks. I can't wait to see that. And
Yeah,
we're
just
like,
get it done.
oh, that's on our work plan for 3 years from now.
They're like, that's not fast enough.
Exactly. And I think you said it best that like we have spent the last century of making arguably poor decisions about how we develop our communities. And I don't it may not have been considered poor decisions at the time, but certainly hindsight is 2020, and we see that now. Oh, we probably would have done things differently if we knew then what we knew now, and maybe some folks did know then what we know now, and maybe weren't heard. But it took a long time to get to this point. It took decades and decades and decades of building out neighborhoods and building out overly built roads that are designed to move cars as fast as possible. And now we're at this moment where we're like, oh, we need to fix all of that, right? But it
Yeah,
took so
we want
long
to
to
catch up for a century of bad urban planning, and that's really tough. It's almost impossible,
exactly.
really.
And it's not going to happen overnight. And
No
I think
way.
that's where the frustration lies, is there's so much desire to see it change, but it takes so much time.
Exactly.
But it's also frustrating because we already see how it's done. There's so many good examples already
Absolutely.
existing,
There's
and you go
many
to
use
them.
cases. Yes.
Yeah, so I've just spent a few weeks in France, and I come back to the UK and I walk around the streets. I'm like, why are they not doing it like the French? It's
Can't
so
we do it
much
like this?
better. It's
Yeah.
really
We're
frustrating. The
inspired from
information
abroad.
is there and the
Yeah.
ideas are there and they have been put into practice and they do deliver good results. But then you still get stuck in people's heads who think, no, roads are for cars, pavements are for pedestrians, and curbs are for delivery vehicles, and that's just the way it has to be. And breaking through those barriers in people's heads is really difficult.
Yeah. It's very
Absolutely. But
binary.
even
Sorry, go on.
just say even just getting projects funded is a challenge. And you both mentioned it. That's how we have to be creative in how we deliver projects, is looking at tactical urbanism as a way to deliver things faster and meet that demand for quicker turnaround on some of these really important infrastructure projects.
Quick build pop up. I mean, we saw some great examples during the lockdowns, although albeit the lockdowns were a bit more strict here in Europe than they were in the US. But during that emergency period, let's say around March, April, May, June of 2020, we saw a ton of emergency related tactical urbanism, social distancing, COVID era, urbanist projects. Of which were across, at least here across Europe, but even in the US, the open streets programs. Germany had some great stuff with pop-up bike lanes in Berlin. We saw Milan, Italy, etc. And all of those were inspiration for what could be done. It, albeit they were experimental, but they were basically painting a picture of the possibilities. And let's say maybe 25% of them have only continued, whereas the rest of the 75% have dropped off and reverted back to autocentricity. It's still a it's a win. It's still a progress because we are kind of moving forward, and now we see these possibilities of how we can kind of rethink our public spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So with that, I think let's move on to our next question here, which is a bit more about the theme today. So Sandra, I'm going to ask you the question, which is, what is the most important kind of aspect for safety of women in public transport and shared mobility?
Okay, that's a big question.
It's your question.
Because yeah, because it obviously it touches on how women feel and how they're received in public spaces in general. Because obviously, public transport is not just my time spent on the train or on the bus, it's my time spent leaving the house, walking down the street, and waiting at the bus stop, waiting at the train station, going through a park. So it's the public space that we really need to look at in general. So we really have to see the big picture here on how can we make women safer in public spaces in general. And I mean, a lot of work has been done in the academic sector on that, in terms of how lighting influences that, how we can rebuild our parks, for example, our urban parklands, to make them safer for women and girls as well, because a lot of the behavior that we learn as women starts when we start exploring our public spaces by ourselves as teenagers, for example. And quite a lot of the times we're pushed back and we're not getting the space that we would require to move around safely and freely. So we kind of then move back again into our home environment, into our car environment, where we can feel safer. And that's a real problem. So we have to really, when we want to answer this question, look at the whole public space environment. And obviously that is also a big question in terms of how do we get our society as a whole to move forward in that regard and really offer women the safe space that they need? But also, when we talk about safety for women, we have to also be prepared to get a bit uncomfortable, because what does that really mean? That means women are threatened. Who are they threatened by most of the time? They're threatened by men. So We need to look at the societal implications there on not just how do we change the lighting and the infrastructure, but also how do we change male behavior to be less violent, to not harass women in public and not assault women in public. So it's a that's why I mean it's a big question. But bringing it back to transport, I mean, there are a lot of things that you can do in terms of education, in terms of making sure your infrastructure is set up in a way that is safe. And also to not automate everything, because I think safety and the perception of safety also relies on the presence of people. So, for example, when you look at the movement of autonomous vehicles in shared mobility, but also in public transport, if you're getting on an autonomous shuttle in the middle of the night as a female passenger or a passenger from the LGBTQ plus community or a disabled passenger, and would you really feel safe if there's no person there that is employed by the public transport or other mobility service operator? So there's that aspect as well. How far do we go with automation, and how much do we still have access to people to provide the safety and the perception of safety? I think that's also something we need to look at. And the UK has a good example here. Last year there was a debate around the closure of ticket offices, for example, in train stations. And there were obviously a lot of people from the disabled community were up in arms, but also a lot of women felt, well, how do I navigate a train station where there's nobody there for me to turn to if I've got an issue? So there are infrastructure issues, there are people issues, and there are sort of big societal issues we need to look at when we debate safety for women.
I think I'm going to pose the same question to Alex, albeit we only have a few minutes, so we're kind of short on time. But really quick thought is this gets back to the Jane Jacobs theme around eyes on the street, though, and softening the scape and creating a mix of uses, a range of activities that make spaces less threatening and safer for all, let's say citizens, male and female, elderly, children, disabled, et cetera. And it really creates this kind of a balance, this balance of and range of activities so that it is less threatening and more communal. So at least just kind of one quick snippet. But Alex, maybe just 1 or 2 minutes, your perspective on the same question.
Absolutely. And I mean, I share Sandra's perspective wholeheartedly. This is not just a transport issue, it's a societal issue. And we could certainly go very deep down a rabbit hole of talking about all the ways that our society is broken in the way of protecting women and other more vulnerable members of our society. But as it relates to transport, I think it really gets down to the issue of perceived safety. And I think in a lot of ways, we often focus on the real safety issues, crash data, like a crash happened. That's real, a real documented safety issue. Assaults or harassment on transit, like that's a real, sometimes a real documented safety issue, many times under reported. But for a lot of women, I think that the perception of safety is just as critical, even if, you're on a quote unquote safe street. It doesn't matter. If you don't feel safe, you're probably not going to want to walk there. That's going to impact the way that you choose to travel. I think women and people who identify as women are generally more risk averse than your average man. And so we're always thinking about what could happen, who's walking behind me, are there people around that I, like Sandra said it, that I can turn to if something happens, or am I going to be on my own? And so I think designing our streets and our transportation systems in a way that fosters participation by many people is a way of helping to improve that perceived safety. You certainly don't want to be the only woman on a bus late at night. That can be a very intimidating scenario. So we certainly want to encourage folks through infrastructure and policy and programs to take transit. So when you get on that bus, there's lots of people on it. You're not the only one. When you're walking down the street, you're not walking down the street by yourself. It's well lit. There are people, there's activity, there are witnesses who can intervene if needed. That just helps provide that reassurance. And then when it comes to not just personal safety, but like traffic safety, you know, having infrastructure that is designed for people who may be a little bit more cautious and more protective of their safety is so important. So we need more protected bike lanes. I know many women who are like, yeah, I don't want to ride in that bike lane that is just paint on the ground. That feels a little risky to me, you know? And so how do we make those people feel more comfortable so that they're incentivized and encouraged to actually use that infrastructure and not necessarily retreat to the safety of a personal vehicle? So I mean we could keep going on this, but those are just my initial thoughts.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So activated public spaces, increased usage of public transit, public transport, as well as improvement in shared and, let's say, segregated and marked infrastructure beyond, well beyond just kind of painted bike lanes, more permanent active infrastructure, not, you know, these kind of temporary measures with, you know, flexible bollards or just a few coats of paint on the ground. Something that is a bit more permanent that signifies that this is a mode that is given enough emphasis that is also perceived as safe as well too. So with that, I believe we're probably running out of time here, but Sandra and Alex, I really want to thank you both for your insights and your time. We will certainly publish both of your links and your work on social media once this episode is published and available on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, YouTube, etc., all the usual channels. We'll closely be following bo both of your work as leaders in shared and active mobility, kind of representatives in the US and in UK. And yeah, just really appreciate your kind of contributions to the industry, your insights, and to kind of help with this dialogue to really cast some light or shed some light on where we're at now, maybe what has been done in the past that's not so great, and some glimmers of hope for how we can really try and, you know, let's say, better organize our streets and our public spaces that are safer for women and all users in the urban environment. So, yeah, thank you so much for your time and joining us on the City's First podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. So, everyone, look for our next episode coming up, actually, just in a few weeks with Nico Larco, who will be joining us. He is the director of Urbanism Next, and he's a professor of architecture at the University of Oregon. So we're really pleased to see him as well too on the podcast. And we have a whole series of guests coming up later this year and early next year as we move into season 4 of the City's First podcast. So we're really excited, and hopefully we'll invite you both back on to the show for a part 2 episode maybe in the coming months and hear about your progress. I think that'd be a great idea.
Sounds good.
All right. So
Perfect.
thank you all, and we will see you soon.